This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The defense admitted Lindsay killed her children before the trial started. The prosecution then spent 14 days and more than 70 witnesses trying to prove premeditation. The Apple Maps search, the takeout order, the timing of when she sent Patrick out of the house. The only question the jury has to answer is whether she was criminally responsible. So essentially, they spent 2 weeks proving something that was really never that much in dispute. Joining us to discuss, we got Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. So they did spend basically 2 weeks proving something that was never much in dispute, but it was emotional. It got people crying. It got people upset. A jury, they had to go on the ride. They're there. They are along for wherever those attorneys take them. In your opinion, did anything from the prosecution land with that jury? Obviously, it's hard to know. We're not there looking at them, but just from absorbing the story that was trying to be told from the perspective of the prosecution, that she premeditated this and she had all of her wits about her while she was doing it. Was there ever a very clear line that was drawn to that, Eric?
In my experience, a lot of attorneys tend to shy away from some of the weaknesses in their case. They might have really strong evidence as to one element, but not so strong evidence as to another. And I think if you are only amplifying, one particular element and sort of ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the weaknesses in your case, you're going to have a problem. I think they were amplifying the alleged premeditation to try to, and there is some evidence that a person could interpret as supportive of premeditation, certainly. But even if we assume that they prove the premeditation piece, they still got this huge issue to resolve regarding whether she knew right from wrong. A person could theoretically plan something, but still not be in the right mind, not know right from wrong, but still engage in planning steps. So I think they focused way too long on what they thought was the highlight of their case while ignoring the problem.
Is it almost kind of like one of those instinctual things that a lot of children do, adults can do too, that are not super evolved? It's let's get louder. Like, if you're not hearing me, it's not that I'm not going to make my argument stronger. I'm just going to amplify my volume. I'm going to get more shocking. I'm going to make you hurt more. That's kind of how it read to me. It's like, oh, this isn't really working. Well, let's bring out this. Let's bring out that trick. Let's bring out the autopsy photos. Things that are not in question here about this case. Let's traumatize you guys. Then are you going to take my side? Then are you going to believe what I'm saying? That's kind of how it felt on the outside looking in. How does that land when that sort of argument is pushed onto a jury of, I'm just going to make you feel it more?
I had that happen in a very serious child death case where I was representing the defendant. He did not do it. We prevailed, not guilty on all counts. But during it, the prosecution, they had other huge holes in their case that they were just ignoring. And instead, they were like, hey, let me show you 40 autopsy photos of this two-month-old with their skull cut open with a saw. And let's look at their brain. And let me show you all this blood. And so on closing argument, I said, hey, these are scare tactics. They're trying to scare you into convicting because they're compensating for the evidence they don't have. So they're trying to get into your emotions and freak you out such that you'll be like, ah, this is such a scary scenario. I better err on the side of caution and convict. And so I blow them up in closing argument for those kinds of strategies, but they happen all the time.
I'm curious also, Eric, I don't know, you probably haven't been able to sit and watch the entire thing because you're actually doing work every day. But from what you've been seeing online and just through your own analysis, what do you think from what you see and how you've seen the prosecution play this, what do you think they think their strength is in this case?
I think they think their strength is sort of the premeditation. You know, there are some suspicious circumstances in terms of, you know, gossip. A person tells their partner to leave the house because they don't want to be caught or stopped in doing some act that they're planning on doing. Well, that looks shady. That doesn't look good. And so I think the evidence of premeditation, and, you know, if I were them, I would have gone through exactly all of the actions Lindsey Clancy had to take to accomplish this. You know, you talk about, I won't get too graphic, but you talk about you go down to where the children are, you grab the band, you affix it in your hands such that you're going to use it, you apply it to the child, you apply pressure until that child, doesn't breathe anymore, and then you do that three more times. That's a lot of steps, man.
At what point, it's a really good, fair point, if you know, the premeditation action obviously is their strong point on this, because there's some actions they can say through internet searches, through sending Patrick out, and through exactly this, because they actually had the forensic experts get up there and talk about how long it takes to perish from strangulation and what it takes to do that, and to do it three times. You know, it's graphic. What balance do you think they could, should they have done more on that? Because you got to ride that balance between what's the impact on the jury? Is it because these prosecutors seem to have a lack of self-awareness at times from seeing the coldness and callousness of their approach to the jury? I think a little insensitive to some of the things they've done. Should they have done more on that? Like, where do you think that balance would have been?
I think it would make sense to go through all those steps I mentioned and be like, is this a person who's so out of their mind that they're flailing about, they can't control their body, they don't know what they're doing, that they're just, you know, acting on pure base visceral impulse and whatever? Or is this a person who had to take probably 20 plus steps in terms of specific actions in order to accomplish the death of these three children? And if so, that starts to look a little more like somebody who is knowingly engaging in action as opposed to just somebody who's, you would be bouncing off the walls in a crazy house.
And then you get Reddington step up there with Dr. Resnick, who completely explained exactly how that works. So it was a good day.
Every prosecution witness who personally knew Lindsay, Patrick, her friends or coworkers, told the jury the same thing under cross, that she was a wonderful mother, that she was loving, that she was, you know, she was great, you know, when she was, had a healthy brain. We've seen so many cases where the prosecution, you know, parades out a lot of people who have a lot of nasty things to say about the person in question. Why do you think we didn't see any of those paraded out in this case?
You know, I'll be interested to see, because there are some rules that would prohibit the prosecution in their case in chief. Anyway, from calling a witness to kind of talk about character traits of the defendant. Typically, you can't do that unless you get prior court approval. For example, if the defendant, just hypothetically, was very violent, they attack people, they punch and kick people, things like that, you could bring such a witness to do that. But what they might do, Tony, is they might do that on their rebuttal case. Yeah. So after the defense is done, they might say, oh, you know, the defense talked about her character for peacefulness or her character for being nurturing. Well, we got some folks who are going to tell you the opposite of that about Lindsey Clancy. If they had such witnesses, it might come out of redirect or rebuttal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if they exist, I mean, my gut, and the case is still ongoing, obviously. There's room for that to happen on the stage, but will it? Do they exist?
I think there's no wobble yet.
There's no wobble. There's nobody on talk shows. I mean, for all of the directions that this case is going in social media and media, wouldn't we have heard some of them on somebody's show at this point talking about what a monster Lindsey Clancy is? I mean, people are going down that road seeking verification of their assumption of who she is. And we've yet to get anybody who actually knew the woman to say that.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, we talk about that. I've thought about this so much, this way too much, this case in the last couple of weeks. It's fascinating to watch people argue against what the family and friends are saying about Lindsay. And I thought about this because I thought about this a lot too. What would it take me? And I think I try to be as critical thinking as possible, open-minded, live in the world of maybe. And I asked myself this question last night. What would it take me, even at this point right now, to say, I think she's guilty? And here's what it would be. It doesn't take much for me to start exploring more. It would take one, even better if you have two people, to do just that. Show me someone in her inner circle that gives a wobble, that says, you know what? That wasn't my experience with her. I'm going to direct my attention there, and I'm going to deep dive and explore that. Have them back up what their testimony is saying. Have them back up what their experts are saying. But you know, they were unable to do that. That's why I'm not wobbling, because no one else is. And it doesn't take much for me to redirect and be very open-minded to something else as a possibility. But to our point on this case, I don't think there is anyone. I've never seen this before. So here's what you typically get. You either get noise against from all these extra wobbles. You get the Lindsay situation, where I've never seen this on one of the cases we've covered before, or you have silence, like in Lori Daybell Valor or something like that, or even Corey Richens, you know, where you have maybe one or two people for, a couple people against, and just you're deafened by the silence that no one wants to speak on their behalf. This is so completely different.
Go ahead, Eric. Just briefly that, if she was this child-killing monster that the prosecution claims she is, I gotta imagine there'd be one person in her life who would be like, yeah, she's dangerous, or she is not how these other folks have described it, and we have just not heard from any such person.
And that's the word I've seen people online using. She's dangerous. She's a manipulator. Watch out for her.
Yeah.
Who in her life has said that? The people that don't know her say that. I'm like, who are you to second guess her doctors, her psychiatrist? I mean, even her doctors aren't saying, they're just saying they didn't know. They're not saying she wasn't. They just didn't know. It's just, I'm sorry, I'm getting on my soapbox.
No, I know. How difficult is it going to be for a jury to understand the concept here of it's the state that has to prove that she was mentally competent, that she understood what wrong was? Because wrong here in this case, it's very much in the context of what Lindsay was processing in her mind at that moment in time. When you're hearing the voice of God tell you, not saying it's the voice of God, it's the psychotic delusion that she's having, that you need to take your kids out because they'll be better off if they're gone before you leave the planet, and you're then planning to leave it as well. And this is what the voice of God is telling you. I mean, that's like one hell of a transcendent experience one is believing they're happening. It kind of overrides all earthly rules and laws, I would believe, if that's what you're thinking is happening. So she may have been in a state where, yes, by earthly laws and rules, you don't kill your kids. But when God's coming to you, well, that's what you got to follow. So I could see you being in a psychotic state, recognizing, yes, by moral standards and decency and everything, this is wrong. But God's coming to me in my head right now, so I got to follow.
And I'm going to follow up with that, because I watched Resnick testify just a little while ago. That wasn't just a command hallucination. According to him, she suffered from physical command. He said that in that state, they become incapable of stopping their physical actions as well. That's what he testified.
Yeah, and I think it's so critical for defense to hammer on that burden you mentioned, Tony. So in a lot of states, in this kind of case, the defense would have some burden to show that they didn't know, couldn't tell right from wrong. That's really hard to prove. Here it's the opposite. Prosecution, they've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she knew right from wrong, and that's going to be very hard with this Resnick testimony.
Yeah. I don't know how they do it. I mean, this just seems to be almost like a textbook definition of someone who is not in their right mind. And here's why. I don't know how you walk away asking people to go see it the other way. Unless they just weren't watching, or it comes down to mortal sin. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts as we continue to follow this case as it gets closer to its conclusion. We'll continue our conversation right there. That'll wrap it up for us for today. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you for being here. And Robin Drake, his latest book, It's Not All About Me. Go check it out. Get it wherever you get books. Leave a review on Apple Pod or on Amazon. Go in and check that out. So used to saying Apple Podcasts. Anyway, and Robin has some interesting news next week. So
yes,
stay tuned.
We got a big drop coming next week. Can't wait
big
to share with
things
you.
Things are happening. So that's next week. So tune in. All right. Until next time, for Robin, for Eric, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.